in the last 3 months or so, that he has been most receptive. He's a good listener. He's been actively engaging people throughout the community with concerns and ideas and issues and suggestions, and trying to engage as many people as he can as a part of the solution rather than as part of the problems. And to me, that's been very refreshing and very hopeful in terms of where I think we can go in terms of making some meaningful change in the district and some leadership from this position in engaging collaboration with other aspects of our community. I'll let him, whenever he wants to introduce Eric Cass, who is the Assistant Superintendent for Business Services. But Dr. Neurath will make some comments and so on, and then we'll open it up to questions, comments, and so forth. Dan.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
And it's a real pleasure, Jim, am I messing with your...
That's all right.
You were fine. Asking me to sit is really kind of a problem. Not that I can't, but if I can stand, number one, I can see all of you, and I want to be able to do that. It's a real pleasure to be here today, and while I'm new in this community, I want you to recognize that part of being new is also the need for me to learn, and I do appreciate your introductory comments, Don, and I thank you very much, because what I want to convey to you is that while I am out learning a lot about the school district, that I am committed to continuing the work around engagement that we've begun since I started here, meaning that this is not the first 100 days I'm out listening to the community and then I go into my office and we make decisions based on that. This is the only way I in fact know how to do this work. I'm committed to continuing that conversation and to listening to people, because these obviously are not Dan Neurath public schools. They're the public schools here in this community. And while I do have ideas about where we need to go, I want to be informed by the community as we identify those places where we need to go. I guess what I'd also want to communicate to you is I don't believe an organization, whether you call it a school district or you call it something else, has ever done in terms of working on where it needs to go next. And some people call that a commitment to continuous improvement, and I'm okay with that, that type of language. But frankly, we have things that we need to commit to in terms of improvement for kids. And if we realize those, there will be other places that we need to go following that. And so that's also part of the commitment I make in coming here. And that is that we'll have a focus on improvement, and we'll have a focus on where we need to go next after we've gotten to certain places. I guess what I want to do in the time I have with you today, and I do welcome an opportunity for dialogue, is to kind of share with you some of my perspectives about what's most important, and also about what we're now focusing on, so you have a sense of that, and you may have some questions about that later on. But I guess first and foremost, while I knew coming here that the first charge I would face is this ongoing issue of funding in the school district, which has obviously led to a November 4th referendum. I knew all that. As Eric and I worked to put that plan together, we tried to do that in balancing not only the needs of our kids for their programs in learning, but also to be very cognizant of the needs of taxpayers in this community. And if it helps later on to get into some of the details how we balance that, obviously I want to do that, but I also don't want this presentation with a group like yours that's committed to community improvement to only be about that, because I think you need to know more about what the vision is that we're trying to work with here. So I hope that's understood. And if we don't have enough time today and you want to have me come back at another time to talk about the details, I'm certainly happy to do that about the referendum. But I knew in coming here that would be the first charge that I would face. And again, I want to emphasize is we put the plan together, which was eventually presented to the Board of Education and supported by the Board of Education. We really did work to balance both of those things. Now, I also realize that some people are going to look at that plan and feel that we, you know, we did a good job of balancing that, and there are going to be individuals that maybe felt, you know, we erred more on the side of, you know, one need as opposed to another need. And just to illustrate that, you know, I have plenty of people that talk to me as advocates for children about, you know, this is an opportunity to consider things that we're not doing as a school district through this referendum. And the eventual set of recommendations I brought to the board did not include additional things. What it included was being able to keep our current programs in place and nothing beyond that at this point in time. But that also leads to the second comment I want to make, because I want you to know that while this district has a strategic plan, that I'm committed beginning around January to bring a very large group of stakeholders together to revisit our entire strategic plan. Now, I say it that way because I also believe, whether we're a school district or a business, that you have to have a very dynamic strategic plan. And once you create it, you have to live it. And then you have to bring people back together every year to talk about whether or not there's reason to celebrate certain things, or there's reason to focus more on areas that, you know, we hadn't considered earlier. And so the first thing I want you to know, beyond facing this financial issue in the district, that it would have been my preference to lead with the strategic planning, but we have to kind of put these in the order that they, you know, that they come. But most important for me to communicate to you is that we are going to engage in very comprehensive strategic planning involving a very large group of stakeholders in this community to talk about the priorities for the school district. Now, I also want to point out to you that doesn't mean everything we're doing should change. And in fact, I hope the process will confirm some very important areas of focus that need to be maintained, like in the areas of literacy. But what it does mean is that this community needs to come into the school district, that it will be a fully engaged process involving school staff with a lot of community members to have that discussion. Because again, this is the community's public schools, and we need to engage around planning as a community on behalf of the children that we serve here. So that will become a major focus for the second semester of this school year. And I'm very encouraged and optimistic about people's commitment to that type of planning process. As I've said to many groups in my first many months here, I do want to listen, and I'm trying to do that in a way, in some non-traditional ways, meaning that I'm not asking people just to come to meet with me. That I, by intent, we're going out into the community. Board members have been joining me, and it's really on people's own terms. You know, and that's why many of these have been set up at ethnic festivals. They've been set up at farmers markets. And I know some people would say that's kind of an unusual thing for a superintendent to do, but that's the only way I know how to get on people's own terms. And people have said a lot of very positive things about the school district, which is very confirming. And they, I think, because it's on their own terms, they've also been willing to talk to me about things that they think we need to do better. And so, but I've said I'm going to listen. But many people have said to me, well, don't you have some ideas? I mean, you know, listening is pretty good, but we have hired you to do this job. And so I do want to talk to you about some of those ideas today, with the understanding that none of this is in final form. But I think you do need to know some of the perspectives I hold around my leadership work as your new superintendent of school. I guess first and foremost, what I want to communicate to you is I understand our mission, and that is teaching and learning, you know, that kids learn well. And at the same time, I want to be able to report to you one of the things I've learned is that there are several strengths in our learning profile as a school district. And that's good, but there are very notable weaknesses that we need to face very honestly. And in today's educational jargon, which we tend to kind of at times overuse, but I can use this one, I think, to make the point, is that there are significant achievement gaps with certain groups of kids in the school district that need to be honestly talked about in a very transparent way, and we need to make commitments, some of which we've already made, and some of which we may need to make that we haven't made to address those achievement gaps. It's important for me to communicate to you that while I believe schools have a broader mission than workforce development, know, we're also in you know, the broad mission is developing young people to be good people. But we do have a part of our mission does relate to workforce development and ensuring that kids have the kind of knowledge and skills when they leave us to either go to their next place of learning or to go to work and to be successful. And I think what our data tells us now is that we have many kids that, you know, we can forecast, you know, an optimistic outlook. But we have groups of kids, and it's a significant issue in the school district where that same type of hope, while I believe achievement gaps must be and can be eliminated over time, they exist right now. We need to face that squarely. And in many ways, what I've come to learn in our learning profile is that in many ways, we look like a tale of two school districts. You know, there was I think this is oftentimes reported in terms of the recent article just referring to one about the number of National Merit Scholars that are in the school district, finalists in the school district. It's an amazing number compared to other urban districts in the state. And that needs to be celebrated. I mean, that really is, I mean, it's almost an over-the-top number in terms of if you compare the number, you know, about 30 here compared to even where I came from. It's a significant difference in terms of number of kids. But at the same time, that's a relatively small number of kids that are National Merit Scholars finalists. And at the same time, I want to be very quick to say we have a lot of kids who are achieving very well that may not meet that standard, but are really ready to go to college and to do well in college and or to go to the workforce. But I think one of the things I see is a great need to be very transparent around where we're not doing so well with kids. And what's also interesting about that, the groups of kids that are furthest away from the standards. And the easiest way that I think about what an achievement gap is you have the standards here, which through the curriculum should have been elevated in terms of, you know, the rigor. So you have the standards here, and when you have groups of kids that are here, that distance is the gap. I mean, that's the easiest way for me to understand that. And so in many ways, the groups of kids, our poverty-level kids, our kids of color, represent the most rapidly increasing populations in our profile of kids, which are the furthest away from our standards. I think there's a compelling need to face that issue because I believe the viability of Madison is dependent on us doing that because it all speaks to that part of that mission called workforce development, which means that kids have the necessary skills to avoid remediation where they go next, you know, that they have a chance to be successful with their next phase of learning without having to take a whole bunch of coursework, and if they decide not to go to a post-secondary institution, that they're good workers. You know, that people can feel a level of confidence in hiring them. Those issues need to be faced squarely, and I believe we can face that. But these are not quick fix kinds of issues. These are commitment kind of issues that we need to face and we need to make as a school district. And I believe this school district is on that journey. But I also believe that part of being on that journey is to talk more openly about those gaps. And what I've asked groups, and I'll ask this of you, that in turn, if I do that, that we have to have the kind of support that says that's an important conversation to take place. Because one of the conclusions could be, you know, the system is broke, and maybe there are some things we need to do differently. I'll keep saying that. There are some things we need to do differently. But if I talk openly about that, we talk openly about that, I hope that's all the more reason that people can be supportive of the school district and not create a sense of abandonment. So I am asking for help with that because that's kind of the quid pro quo, if I can use that language, and that is that I believe an organization, again, a school or whatever you call it, should be absolutely bold and transparent about where we're not good. At the same time, because we are a public institution, we need public to understand that that's good conversation to take place, and that's all the more reason why we need to join forces around mutually addressing these achievement gap issues. And so I guess what I mainly go through that to tell you that my overarching commitment in being here is to focus on improvement and learning for all kids. And what I mean by that, it's a both-and proposition. It's not an either-and proposition. And I'm a little bit worried in our community, and some of it's been, I believe, driven by this continued budget discussion. it's now been framed up, if we're helping this group of kids, we're not helping this group of kids. And we've got to be about a conversation about helping all kids, from my perspective. So, if you are meeting standards for those kids, there are next places that we need to take them with their learning. In the vernacular, we call that proficiency. Their proficiency means you're meeting the standards. But there's also advanced proficiency. And I believe we have a commitment to ensure that those kids who are meeting standards isn't their stopping place. It's a good sign. I mean, it's something, in fact, to celebrate. But there are next places that we need to take those kids. And at the same time, we need to focus in a bold way on those achievement gap issues. It's a both-and proposition. It's not an either-or proposition. And I'm hoping, if I'm right about the way the conversation has been framed up, we have an obligation to reframe it. I believe I have an obligation to reframe it. Now, I'll tell you one of the reasons why I feel so strong about this is the very things that are going to help kids who are meeting standards to go to their next place are the same things that are going to help kids who are not meeting standards. It's called best practice. It's what we know about good curriculum practices, good effective instructional practices, good pedagogy, and contemporary assessment. And so my view, not to be overly simplistic, is that our commitment on achievement gap issues is to all the more focus on what we know works for kids with their learning. And it will require some special programs. I realize that. We have some special programs right now. But for me, the very things that are going to help kids who are meeting standards applied in an intense way to kids who aren't on the same kinds of issues. So it's all about good practice, educationally speaking. But let me just talk, and then I'll try to wind up my comments so we have time to talk with each other, is there are some other conversations, even in front of the strategic plan and with the strategic plan, that I think we have an obligation to have in the school district. And so I have five areas I want to highlight. And at the same time I do that, many of these, most of these, are not with a plan right now. I'm trying to help people understand some of what's in my head. And that's the spirit in which, you know, I go through this. I believe that we have an obligation to have another conversation about early learning opportunities for children. You can call it four-year-old kindergarten, you can call it some other things. It's not just the school district, it's a community as well. And a community has a responsibility as well. And the reason why I think we have an obligation to have that conversation again is because if we can deal with achievement gaps before they widen, we can do this, in fact, in a better way for children and in a more cost-effective way over time. And here's one of the things I find most interesting about this whole area, is some of the key writers are the business community around the business case for early learning. You can look at things like the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank has actually committed, and I'm not quite sure how they got there, but have committed resources to examining the cost-benefit of early learning opportunities for children. And so I find it very interesting that there are communities out there different than educators that are now having that conversation. Because once those gaps widen, it really is, you know, very hard at times, although we can do it. We have to have that view, we can do it. But the focus really should be on preventing that widening. So that's one conversation I want us to have. The other second thing I want to point out to you is the district this year has been the beneficiary of a very large federal grant called the Small Learning Communities Grant. What's most important about that's a grant for high schools. But what's more important is let's use that as a conversation to talk about what we want our high schools to be going forward. Now, here's my perspective on that. The American high school, basically every one of us in this room, regardless of our age, basically went to the same high school. Now, we had different courses. The periods may have been a little bit different. But the structure has been in place for over 100 years. And here's what I'll say about that. One of the reasons that's the case is because there are enduring positive qualities of the American high school. But at the same time, I'm of the view that our high school, we need to be more responsive with our high schools today. There are things that we can do differently that will help more kids and help the community in turn. Let me talk to you about a couple of ideas. One is, in large institutions, it's oftentimes hard, I'll say it positively first, for some kids they can very easily find their place. I have two kids. One did. Our second did not. Not that he was in real trouble in school, but he was basically lost in a large high school in Green Bay. And he was happy with being lost. I mean, and I know that kind of sounds, but he didn't want to be noticed. But the problem with that is, did he fully maximize his learning? And I don't believe he did. I think later on, he's 24 now, later on, he kind of turned it around and kind of got it. But part of what American high schools have to do a better job on is finding a place for all kids and keeping them with us. The second thing, I just mentioned two ideas. Again, these are not in final form, but I believe our curriculum can be more career-based. And what I mean by that is I think one of the things that people like about the high schools, American high schools, whether you're in Madison, Green Bay, wherever else, is they like the comprehensive nature of them. The wide array of courses, the wide array of co-curricular programs, people like that. But at the same time, I think we can do some specialization within to be more responsive on the workforce development side than we are right now. I'll give you an example. Where I came from, we had four high schools, large high schools. They each had a specialized career academy coursework within them that were aligned to very specific career clusters. One was in the area of healthcare. We literally had kids, this is a fairly good-sized number, that were graduating high school with a certified nursing assistant degree at the same time. And then when I left, we actually had a very small number, but I was thrilled by it, that were graduating high school with an LPN degree at the same time. And we can think this way, and especially if we engage this conversation with the university and the technical college system. This whole idea of how kids move through schools is person-made. And so we've got to break down some of these silos to be able to allow kids to experience curriculum. Even if at the end of the day they say, I don't want to do healthcare, that's fine. Because they're 18 years old or 17 years old. But as a parent, when they're 22 and 23, and they say, I don't want to do healthcare, and there's been all kinds of family investment around healthcare, the consequences are much greater. So in no way am I saying that every kid has to have this rigorous career major in high school, but I do believe we can be more focused around curriculum opportunities, and I hope we can use this grant to have that part of that conversation as well. So high schools is the second thing. Three other things, and then I'll wind up quickly. I want to revisit the entire conversation around issues of school safety. And I want to do that with a threefold focus. One is in the area of curriculum, and that is, what do we do in curriculum, in the area of curriculum, to help kids learn how to deal with their differences in positive ways? What do we do to help them learn how to deal with conflicts constructively? So I think we do have a piece on the curriculum side. Not alone. The community must join us in that effort. Second, I want us to revisit our entire response system, our safety plan. And what I'm of the mind, and I shared this with Chan, is that earlier, is that school safety planning, you're never done today. It's a sad commentary that we've allowed our society to evolve where violence has crossed the schoolhouse door. My strong bias is schools, and I don't mean this in a religious sense, but you'll get the point, should be the safest sanctuaries anywhere in a community. And somehow we've allowed society to evolve where there have been times where that hasn't been assured. When we send our kids to school as parents, I know some of you, one of you said just parent, I agree, you got to get rid of that. That's a very important role. We want them to learn well, we want them to have fun, but as a parent, we don't want to have to worry about whether they're safe in school. I mean, that should not be part of our lexicon. And unfortunately, it has been part of our lexicon. So I believe that we have to revisit our response systems on an ongoing basis. And part of that, which is the third part, and I'll assure as we look at this that we'll be research-based with this, because I think we can also look more at what some of the technology that's available relative to school safety today. Technology in and of itself is not an answer. And there are people that say, well, put metal detectors in schools, and I can tell you there hasn't been one study completed that would recommend them. So my point in saying that is we can't do things to create an allure of safety. We have to, you know, do things that make sense using good technology. And so I think what I want to convey to you is that we have to have an ongoing commitment to to this whole issue of school safety. And where I came from, I'll just use one example, and I'm trying not to go back, but I want you to know what has influenced me. And where I came from, as a superintendent of schools, I was involved with an averted Columbine that was that close from happening in a very, very, very bad way in one of our high schools. And what that taught me is that we cannot do the safety plan last year and then be done with it. I mean, it's an ongoing commitment to looking at school safety. And then just two other things quickly. This month, the Board of Education received a math task force report. Prior to my coming, the board commissioned two task forces. First one was in the area of mathematics. There's some good news in that report, but there's also news confirming what I said earlier. And even on the good news side, I don't know if you know this, but by proportion compared to the other urban districts, Madison students take less total credits in math than the other urban districts in the state. I think we have to have a conversation about that. And what ends up happening in districts where they have two math credits is to graduate, literally you can stop at the end of 10th grade. And what worries me is I don't think that's enough math on that point about skills necessary to be able to transition effectively to where you want to go next. I'm not saying what the solution is in any way, but I think we have to have that kind of conversation. And then that report also helped us, again, reaffirm the notable difference in achievement with some groups of kids in our school district. That has to be faced squarely. And so I think there are things in that report, not only for advanced learners, that are good news, and yeah, but what about the total credit load in math? But there's also things that will be very instructive for kids who are not meeting standards in math. And then next month, the board is going to receive another task force report in the area of fine arts. And both of those were commissioned, obviously, long before I came here. And, you know, the fine arts community, I've met with many representatives that have a feeling that Madison has a strength in this area that's now been whittled away. I mean, that's the perception that they've shared with me through some reductions that have occurred in, you know, budget planning, you know, budget reductions. Those two reports, I'm committed over time, and I've told both groups, please be patient with us, because I think there's reasons why we have to do better in math, clear reasons, and I think we also have to revisit the conversation about this whole area of fine arts in terms of, you know, what those programs provide our kids, and there's relationship through research that says that kids who are involved in these programs do what better in the academic area. I mean, so that's point number one, but point number two, I believe these programs allow kids to develop in the fullest way possible. And so, you know, I can't turn clocks of hands back. That's not my point. But my point is we can deal with the clock going forward, and we can have these conversations about math as well as the fine arts area. And I want to have those conversations. So those are some of the things that I'm committed to us focusing on. None of that's in final form. And as much as we can do the strategic planning process to say what the priorities are as a community and the board, you know, then acting on the strategic plan, that will create the roadmap going forward. And that's what I want to do. So, yes, I have ideas. I've shared five of them with you. But this has to be my ideas joined with the community's ideas. And that's the way I'll have us do our work. Before we turn it over for questions, Eric Cass is also new in the leadership team here. He came here at the same time that I did. He came from Waukesha. I came from Green Bay. And Eric has been very instrumental in helping me think differently and with different ideas about this whole area of how we address school funding, how we address our budget. So I just wanted to give Eric a few minutes to be able to talk, and then we'll open it up for questions.
You bet.
All right. Eric, go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. Dan said, I'm Eric Cass. I'm not going to take a whole lot of time, but as Dan said, I started around the same time. It's kind of been a sprint since July 1st around providing information and creating recommendations and trying to figure out exactly where we are. If you followed us on the newspaper at our board meetings, we redid our full projection to look at what our budget gap is, and we can get into that as questions arise, but we needed to get our comfort level where it needed to be with a budget projection model that we've used here in Madison for about 5 or 6 years, and luckily something that I was familiar with. So we've completed that work. As we move into November and past the referendum, some of my goals over time and some things you'll see from me, and I've had conversations with Don around this, are looking at our financial system and the processes that we create here in Madison. Madison School District, at least financially, and in a lot of areas, is very process-driven. Not necessarily all processes are, how should I put it, effective in today's market, in today's age. So we will be doing a lot of work around how we do business. A focus that I've had in the past is shared partnerships with different community organizations, whether it be the city, whether it be the county, whether it be other things. In Waukesha, we put a focus on that and had great relationships with the city specifically on shared services, whether it be snow plowing, grass cutting, just to name a few things, but a large focus on that conversation as well. And then my background prior to me being in school business was in the financial analyst type work. So analyzing different programs from a financial aspect and looking at how we spend our money. Is it effective? What does it mean? How is it broken down? Whatever that does mean in putting processes together. That work was started and a lot of it was accomplished in Waukesha. And hopefully I can bring some of those experiences here to Madison. And I understand that different communities, different expectations, but a lot of that work will be completed over the coming year, which hopefully will be important. So I think the final goal is, too, is to provide as much information to groups such as you and to the community in general. That's number one, accurate, number two, honest, and number three, understandable. I think public finance, unfortunately, is a beast that is hard to understand at times because there's so many moving pieces. So the challenge to me and my staff is to provide information, like I said, that's accurate, but also that's understandable to the community. And rather than putting a budget out there that's a string of 16 numbers that people try to understand, what does that mean in creating those conversations and talking to the community about how that information can be understood and putting it in places, number one, that people can access, and number two, that people can understand. And then the last thing that I would like to say is you know, just like Dan, having open conversations and having an open door to converse with the community. I've met with Don numerous times, but I'm open to meeting with all different types of community members, whoever they may be, to answer questions, to provide information, because I think that is important, whether you're talking about a referendum or whether you're talking about a budget or whether you're talking about a program. Fortunately and unfortunately, the finance piece of it fits in somewhere in all of these conversations, and we're more than interested to provide information that the community desires, that the board desires, that Dan desires. So excited to be here, and hopefully we can get into some of those things within the coming year. So thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much for setting that platform for us and a place to interact. Questions, comments, suggestions from folks. Don't all jump at once. I know there are some.
Yeah.
Jonathan?
I just want to ask you what would happen, what plans do you have in place in case a referendum does not pass? And secondly, seems that over the years, several teachers in the Madison School District have been more interested in practicing politics rather than teaching kids how to become better citizens. And have you addressed that?
Well, let me respond to both of those questions. As part of the work that we did, and it was a preliminary list, where we identified $8 million that we would look at reducing if the referendum isn't successful, because frankly there is no other option but to do that. And part of the reason why I wed that discussion about referendum with strategic planning is so people understand what I'm committed to doing, but I also believe it would have been wrong, it is wrong, for me to be in a position, I can do it, and I'll tell you about my last day in Green Bay before I finish. We can do that work, but I want to engage the community on what are the priorities. And so to come in on the front end and then say, well, here's this list of $8 million, which we have identified where that money would come from, I think would be wrong, because some of those things may be things with the benefit of time and planning, we would not go there. We'd go some other places. So the most direct answer to your question is that we would have to make reductions equaling that $8 million gap. And we have a preliminary list, but I'm part of what I'm saying to you is I'm not entirely comfortable with all the things that are on that list. And the amount of time we put it together was a very short amount of time because, that was the first 6 weeks of Eric and my relationship is kind of sorting through how do we deal with this as we go. Your second point, I understand that perception. And, I've had people talk to me about the union politic here, and I understand that that's a dynamic here. And I know at times it does go to individual teachers that you may perceive. But one of the things I think is really important, and I'm going to work to do that too, is to separate out, the teachers from any of that politic part. And one of the things I'm doing, which is it's also an interesting part of my learning here, is I'm spending time in each of our schools. And it's going to take me until about mid-November to get them all done. And I've started last week, and I'm spending over an hour in each school talking to the principal, having them take me around, seeing teachers practicing. And I've seen good practice. And in no way do I want you to take that as if there aren't teachers that, don't have places that they can improve their practice. But I do perceive a commitment on the teacher level, on the classroom level, to continuously learning and trying to figure out how to educate children well. And so, in some ways, I guess what I'm saying is, yeah, I understand that politic, but I also want us to understand what happens at the classroom level. And because, if anything, I think what we need, and I think there's great things happening here, is to help teachers, volunteer, engage in projects like the Schools of Hope Project. There's many others. Because they do need help with the kids that they're dealing with. But I guess what I'm saying is that, there's that, and then there's the politics. And I think we can work hard to make that distinction. Because I do see people committed. I mean, that's one of my perceptions that I've developed so far. I haven't been everywhere, and I need to go to a lot more places yet. But I've seen a commitment to good practice, and my commitment is in part to help them improve their practice. I mean, that's one of the things that a superintendent does, and that is, what do we need to do on the professional development side to ensure that we're advancing knowledge and skills of our practitioners? So, that's just, I guess, as well as I can respond given what I know right now.
Okay. Nancy? Mistel.
Well, it was probably one of the most former conservative board members that this community had. But I'm sitting here between two people who would have made a great impact on the board. We've got a lot of historical knowledge that we can offer you. Mm-hmm. And I'm certainly encouraged by your conversation, but I would say that if walking in here and within 6 weeks' time we're looking at a referendum, it looks a lot like the same old yeah. to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Which I think is unfortunate because it sounds like you've got a different vision. And Eric, I'm impressed to see, I think it's Fund 41 or Fund 14?
41.
I'm impressed to see that there's an attempt to save taxpayers some money. And quite frankly, I'm very surprised that there's nobody in this district who's been bright enough to have found that before. So whether or not if any of those folks are still in this district, maybe we want to rethink their ability to be here. And I dare say if you mention my name to John Matthews, he'll get hives. Mm-hmm. But I think you really do need to engage that part of the community that has not been heard for a very, very long time. And I'll volunteer my services.
Well, and I appreciate that. And that's in fact what I want to do. I guess, but part of what I'm saying is, well, I didn't say this, but and I will say it now. And that is that I knew coming here that this would be the first. I did say that this would be the first issue that we would face. And in fact, the only alternative with that gap is to in fact reduce programs. I mean the revenue cap takes us there as an option. And I know there are different views about you've cut this, you could cut this much more. At the same time, I want you to know that as many people that may talk to me about that are talking to me about we haven't done this and we should do more of this. And I think both have a legitimate perspective. And I'm trying to honor those perspectives and incorporate them in my planning. So I know I get the point of how it looks. But I also think, and this is the part I didn't say, that all this begs, this state has to have a conversation about school funding. And I think that conversation has to be about two things. Very simplistic. Is what does it cost to educate a child in this state? That may strike you as a fairly direct question, but I can tell you that's a very complex question. And the other question that needs to be included in that is, what does it cost when we fail to educate a child well? And I believe, I'm biased by the view that there are serious societal consequences. I don't know how many states do this, but kind of a bizarre example that I oftentimes will share with groups, that one of the methods that's used to project the number of prison beds needed in the state is the third or fourth grade reading assessment. And so people understand the relationship between lack of productivity educationally and the consequences for states, for communities. We need to have that conversation, because I also believe that that there are kids in this community that if we don't educate better, this community is going to have serious consequences in terms of long-term viability. So I'll have us do due diligence, but in turn, we do need to have that conversation, and I see very little of that at a public policy level at the state. And part of it's our fault as educators, because we have not gotten to a compromise in terms of what a plan for school funding, what that could look like. Because what superintendents do, if you don't know this, is you react to school funding plans by spreadsheet. So what you do is this plan comes out, you look on the line called Madison, and you see at the end if there's a plus or a minus. And if there's a minus, you aren't supportive of that plan. And my point is, it's going to take every different funding group to compromise to be able to get to a common place, a common discussion. So, and then the last thing I would want to say, and Eric and I have had many, many discussions about this, and I do understand the perspective of why not fund 41. But the only thing that we can do is go from the tip of our nose forward. And I understand how people react to that, but it would have been wrong for us not to bring that Fund 80 change forward, which is reducing the levy for Fund 80, that community service fund, by $2 million next year. And it would have been wrong to not have brought Fund 41 forward, knowing that both of them project a tax rate of 1.11% increase in the first year. And then in the second and the third year of the referendum, there's actually a tax rate decrease that's projected through both of those mechanisms. Because what he and I, the conversation we had, and this is almost it verbatim, is if we're going to go to a referendum, are there some things that we can do to mitigate the tax impact, to help taxpayers? We had that conversation. He knew about Fund 41, we both knew about Fund 80. We brought both of them forward. So I understand the perspective, but the only thing I can do is live this, you know, now going forward. And thank you. And I do want to, I mean, I'm more than wanting to listen to different groups.
Before I get to you, Jonathan, I want to piggyback on this. What is your take or perspective as far as looking at budgets and so forth and programs and services for an analysis of their costs and their benefits and their results, which is, in my opinion, another side to looking at what it is you're going to cut, what data do you have.
Yeah. Well, let me just kind of respond this way. When we do our strategic plan, one of the things we'll do at the tail end of that is I want to create outcome measures for each of the priority strategies in the plan. And then we'll live that over a period of time, and ask and answer the question every year, how are we doing? Now, that question doesn't necessarily mean that a program itself is problematic. It may mean that we may not have the right solutions, or it may mean that we need to do more of that if we're going to make a true difference. But so I guess part of what I want you to know is that we will have outcome measures that will be linked to each of the priority strategies in the strategic plan. It's going to take us a little bit of time to do that work well. And then we'll have an annual report on outcome, you know, attainment, non-attainment, where are we at with that? you asked a little different question. I am interested in program evaluation. But I also have to say a couple things, and that is I need to learn what is our current commitment to program evaluation, because I know we're doing some of it. And if we want to do more, what is the financial commitment appropriately to do that? And then the other thing I want to be able to say is that part of the problem in educational research, and I don't want this to be taken as excuse, is, but it's technically correct, and that is that one of the problems is that you, if you want to do pure experimental research, you have to apply part of the intervention. You have to apply the intervention to one group, but not to another group, and there are some ethical problems with that, because if you know if kids are struggling with reading, I think we have an obligation to do something. And so I guess the only other thing I would say is that it has to be good social science research that really will yield results that we can have a conversation about, and that are in fact not going to set us up to prevent us doing something for kids, because if it's not this program or not this service, we still can't let those achievements get. We have to do something. So, again, I'm a proponent of evaluation, but we also have to say, what's our current commitment? What would it cost to do it more completely? And then we also have to have fair evaluation, is what I'm saying.
Jonathan Berry.
Thank you. My name is Jonathan Berry. I have a similar checkered past to Nancy. Different office.
Yeah.
I want to really thank you right off the bat for your clear enunciation of the challenge in terms of maintaining a world-class education, but then recognizing that the increasing demographic change in our community and the failure to reach a lower socioeconomic grouping is kind of burgeoning.
Right.
And I worked for the last 6 or 7 years with a nonprofit called Operation Fresh Start, which has kind of become a passion for me. And we work with at-risk youth who have 99% dropouts from your institution, frankly, or metropolitan institutions here. And recently we had a United Way-led task force that identified that we have about 4,000 what we'll call disconnected youth in the greater metropolitan area, probably 2,000 or 3,000 of which are of school age. And so a disconnected youth, just for the definition, is a young person who is not in school, of school age, not in school, not holding a job, nor seriously looking for a job. And I guess a corollary to that is they're not equipped for employment in a number of ways. A lot of it's related to behavior. So Madison Metropolitan District is the only district in the county and one of only two in the state that will not contract with alternative schools for the provision of education for people who have dropped out. And that really kind of fries me, because we could, at Fresh Start, with a 900-person waiting list, enroll a large number of people right now. And were you to take a person and re-enroll them in your institution and then contract with an alternative school provider, it's worth $12,000 or $13,000 per student to the school district. And the reason for not doing this in Madison is the teachers' union contract. Bluntly, they say nobody shall educate that's not a member of Madison Teachers. Notwithstanding that our teachers are state certified, notwithstanding that every other school district in the county will do this, and the only other school district in the state that doesn't do it is Milwaukee, for similar reasons. And so I guess what I want to ask you is, if this is a tough nut, because Art Rainwater would go ballistic when you bring it up, and wouldn't even discuss it.
Yeah.
And I think if we've got 4,000 young people, let's say we can enroll only 1,000 of them, well, that's $13 million brought back to the community. That's serious money to address a population that I assure you is well represented in our crime statistics,
right,
is creating a huge social burden in the community.
Right.
And so to sum it up rather than lecture, I really want to say I appreciate what I'm hearing about what you intend to do to try and obviate the growth of this population.
Right.
And I really appreciate it, because the first goal ought to be to keep the people in school,
right,
keep the kids in school. We concur. But really, we ought to tap some of the resource for the alternative opportunities the statutes provide for under Section 118, and you can make a contract for the provision of alternative education, and even put some standards in there. We'll need it.
Right.
And so we would like to be part of your toolbox in a more effective manner.
Well, thanks. Thank you. And I should add to you, to your comments that one of the reporters I met with who knew about your program told me I really needed to sit down and talk with you. So, and I do have your number. I just haven't been...
The director is Connie Ferris Bailey.
Yeah.
She'd love to talk with you.
Those were the two names that were given to me, in fact. And so I do want to have that conversation. Let me just say a couple things. One is that, especially relative to poverty, my bias is there's no greater disequalizer for children. And one of the things I'm very concerned with is, you know, the disproportionate number of kids that aren't doing well that are from those family backgrounds. I have a strong bias that we need to act. And I know there are different views about the people and their responsibility, you know, parental responsibility, but at the end of it, there's always a kid. And there's always a kid that you never know what's going to turn them around. And so one of the things I do want to have a conversation about, because the high school principals have talked to me about it, is where are we at with alternative programs in the school district? And they weren't when they said that to me, it was with the idea that they felt we should be doing more. But it was, none of it was related to who the provider was. Okay, so you know, I would need to be able to say that. I offer one cautionary note about alternative programs, is I think we need to do more, likely do more than what we are right now. At the same time, what we have to guard against is framing that up as an either-or thing. You've got a problem with the kid, therefore alternative programs. That might be the right solution. But another solution is how do those high schools become more responsive to kids in need. We have to be on both fronts, both helping the high school become a more connecting institution, and as well as looking at alternative programs. But one of the things I'll say to you is I come here with no biases about what has happened in the past. And I know, like on the issue of four-year-old kindergarten, I know there's going to be big barriers to that discussion. But I'm going to commit to the same thing with this, because it's all about kids. And that is, we need to have the conversation again. And, you know, just like we need to have the conversation again about what happens in this community when we don't educate kids well. They come to your program. I get that. And so if that means that we need to go in a different direction, I'm not afraid to have conversations with people about that. I may be successful with them, we may not, but I want you to know I'm willing to have a conversation.
I'll narrow that just to clarify. I'm really talking about the young person who's dropped out of school, who's been dropped out for a year, and is under the age of 21.
Yes.
You know, that person, if re-enrolled, will start triggering state aids, transportation aids, levy limits, cap room, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so within that lies a potential resource. But you're right, keep them in school if you can. And
well,
however you can do it, please do it.
Right. And I want to make sure you hear that I do believe we need some more alternative approaches just based on what the principals are told me right now. But so I guess my message, Jonathan, I'm willing to have a conversation. I don't know where it's going to go, but let's have it.
That's an improvement right
there. Judy Reed and Gary.
I met you earlier this meeting, and I do appreciate that you will meet with me. I got my doctorate last year in alternative, studying the at-risk child and what teachers and professionals believe they should, how they should teach them, as well as identification. So I look forward to having a conversation on the results, because they do tell us the one thing that does make the difference that we all know, and I was on the United Way Committee and the GAME Task Force Committee for Education also, relationships.
Right.
So we can educate all the teachers and we can have lots of different things, but again, the number one thing with these kids is relationships. And the school that I run, just so you know, this is our 16th year, and we have a 97% graduation rate, and we take kids from all around Dane County and out of Dane County to our program, which is actually in the Village of Mall. And we are working on a seamless transition with METC. So I guess my problem with, and in the past, not the present, with Madison is I didn't understand why there had to be one dropout without trying.
Right.
So I appreciate what you said.
Yeah, I'm biased by the same. I really am. And yet I know that these systems, I mean, sometimes they're just kind of, you know, there's rigor mortis that have set into them, and there's all these silos. And so I'm not a person that can do magic, but I can do the conversation. We have to have the conversation about what happens if we fail. What happens to this community? What happened to that young person? What happened to this community if we fail?
Gary Schmerler, followed by Phil Salton.
It's a perfect segue for the question that I've got. I had some previous experience as a parent volunteering my time and got involved a little bit with the whole charter school movement. Right. And my question to you directly is, given best practices and what a high school is going to be or what it's not going to be in the future, is there any consideration being given? There was a movement about a year or two ago about putting together a Dane County consortium to put together a charter school whereby maybe some best practices or some things can be worked on to as a group,
right?
As opposed to having all individual school districts. And I can tell you that the previous administrator, when I asked that question directly to him, the answer was, if you don't belong to the Madison School District, there isn't anything any better. So it was very difficult for, at that point of the conversation, from my perspective, just shut down. But as a parent of a special needs kid and a kid that kind of floats through the system, as you described, willing to volunteer time, I was wondering if you would support or if you have any feelings about that.
I do have feelings about that. And I can't remember the name of, there's a group of the other school districts that have fairly recently organized to look at some career-based curriculum, like I referred to earlier. And that, I don't know if that was part of that earlier conversation. So, I mean, I can't connect the dots real well, but I guess I can make a point. And that is that we contacted them to say, can Madison have a place at the table?
Okay.
And so, again, it may have been a completely different initiative, but I want you to take out of that more the philosophy than what initiative it was, because we can bring something to the table and we can take something in terms of, and I don't mean literally.
I understand. But in other words, you're open. You're receptive to looking at it.
Yeah, because, in fact, we've assigned a district administrator to be on Dane County planning group that's looking at these different types of career-based curriculum approaches. We've already done that.
Okay.
And so, yeah, no, I'm open. At the same time, I want you to know that I'm fairly lukewarm yet, although you'll know where I'm at, and then I'll tell you, my mind isn't closed, but on the charter piece, because what we think happens through a charter oftentimes doesn't happen through a charter, and what we fail to answer is, why do people want charters? And I believe the answer is because of dissatisfaction with the school district. I mean, that's why people want to go that way. Less because it may be more effective in the end for kids. And so my question is, are there some things that we can do more response? We may not be able to do it. But we're engaged with a discussion right now with one of the charters, there are only two in the district, about either extending that or maybe we can do some of that as a district. Does it always have to come through a charter? So what I'm trying to convey to you is that may be one approach, but at the same time, I think I have not seen research yet that would say that it's any better.
Well,
but I want you to know, I understand why people go there. They go there because they see school districts being inflexible.
And to your point, having experienced it personally,
okay,
I understand that perspective. But the real objective is to use the charter or the system to create the Dane County consortium,
right,
of sorts.
Right.
It's a mechanism, I guess.
Yeah, no,
I
get it.
To try to establish some best practices and so on.
No, I do understand that, and that's why I conveyed to you that we made a call to the other school district saying, can we be a part of the conversation?
Okay. Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, Phil Salkin.
Thanks, Don. Two quick things. I would hope everyone in the room would go to their computers and Google Wisconsin Way. This is a multi-year effort by WEAC, the Wisconsin Realtors, the Wisconsin Counties Association, Alliances of Cities, and others to take a fresh look at the way we fund public education in Wisconsin. It's something that we all understand has problems, but it's obviously one of the most vital services we provide. So please look at the Wisconsin Way and consider becoming involved. The second thing I'd like to say is how refreshing it is to hear a conversation from a government entity that uses words like financial analysis, cost-benefit analysis, workforce development, et cetera, et cetera. In the current economic environment for municipalities and for school districts, it's going to be very important for them to be able to say that they provide a valuable service, and that's an obvious. but they are providing it in the most cost-efficient manner. In return for that approach from Dr. Neerad, I think we then have to understand the requirement of society to financially support those things. So they go hand in hand. With the request for that financial support comes the responsibility of providing it in the most cost-beneficial manner.
Right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, and I agree with what you said.
Chan and then Dave. Chan Strumman?
I'd like to jump back to the whole school funding reform issue. It's almost a mantra. I remember, you know, every time you send an email to whether it's a school board member or the past superintendent saying, I'm concerned about this issue, oftentimes you get a reply that would invariably end with either, we can't fix this until we get school finance reform, or we can't fix this because the school finance system is broken. And likewise, you know, even in the context of the referendum discussions, there's a, well, we're buying time until we can figure out how to be more efficient and fix the school finances.
Right.
What I don't hear are specifics of that. I mean, are you saying, Joe Quick, go and try to eliminate the QEO? Or are you saying, Joe Quick, go and try to eliminate the revenue cap?
Yeah.
Or is it something else? And as someone who writes a check to the IRS and the state of Wisconsin Department of Revenue, as well as the property taxes, any net increase is something that I'm concerned with. So.
Oh, and I do understand that. To answer your question, I don't believe you can have, with the three-legged stool funding formula, you cannot have a, we cannot have a conversation about one leg. It has to be a conversation about the entire thing. But let me also tell you, you know, there was a state Supreme Court case not that many years ago that found the current funding formula constitutional. And then there was a but. I'm not using the exact language because I don't have it here. But metaphorically, there was a but. And that but was, it cost more to educate some kids. And so it said, additional resources must be provided for kids from poverty, with kids from second language backgrounds, and with kids with disabilities. And there has been no legislative response to that. And what I've wondered about is, I'm kind of surprised that there hasn't been another lawsuit in the state somewhere for failure to implement that provision of the Vincent v. Voight case. Because it said, the formula is constitutional. And now let me make it very real. And it's not just about the state. But when all the laws went into place to serve kids with disabilities, and let me say this right from the start, there are legal and moral reasons those children need to be served well. I'll repeat that. There are legal and moral reasons those children need to be served well. But the federal government said, with all these mandates, we're going to provide 40% funding for special education programs. And they're at 11%. So where would we be if the federal government had lived that commitment? And I think we'd be at an entirely different place with this discussion, as well as for second language learners. Because what ends up happening, And I know this may not be acceptable to some people, but this is my perspective. Because we haven't resolved the immigration issue at the federal level. It comes to the local level, and all the issues that present itself in terms of educating children well. So if we're going to end up having children from other cultures, I'm of the mind that that'll help our kids here. That there is great opportunity, because the world our kids are growing into is a world of vast difference. And when they have an ability to interact with kids from different cultures, they get leg up stuff. But if that's going to happen, where's the commitment? If there's going to be the mandate to serve those kids, where's the commitment in funding? And the same with second language learners. There is no, I mean, I don't know what percent we get right now for those programs. What is it, roughly? Don't hold them to that.
11%.
11% again. And so I think we'd be at a different conversation. And again, I don't want to put it all on the mandates, but there are mandates. And there are mandates in those areas to serve kids. And what I'm saying is I'll be responsive to any mandate that's creative, but put a fiscal note on it.
and have the conversation about if you're going to have that mandate, then back it up with the resources. Because here's what ends up happening. It all rolls into the local school district. And then we have conversation about fine arts programs at the expense of something else. Because the question was asked earlier, what will happen if the referendum isn't successful? We will reduce $8 million. We'll have to reduce, because the revenue cap is a revenue cap. And so I think part of it is, you go back to your question, two answers. One is it can't be about one of the three lakes. It has to be about the entire formula. But I also think, and the reason why I went down that road of kids with disabilities and ELL, there are things that could be fixed in the current funding formula to make it right. Because I believe adequate funding for those kids based on the federal commitment that was made to school districts would have create a whole different conversation at the local level.
Okay, I'm going to take one more question from Dave and then give Dan a last statement, if you will. And then we have two important announcements so that we can end up at 9 o'clock here. So, Dave Glom.
Okay, I'll try to make this short and succinct. It's not easy. First of all, I want to thank you, Dan. I've been to a number of meetings, and I have said to you, and I will say it again in front of this group, that you're a breath of fresh air, and that your ability to get some transparency in getting the information that your predecessor did not share with the rest of us, citizens of the community. And what I'd like to ask you, since we all know that the largest part of the budget has to do with the teacher's contract, are you willing to address the fact that that teacher's contract, the timing of that contract negotiation, is always out of sync with the budget, so that you have always dealt with the teacher's contract and then whatever is left is what is debated in terms of the budget? In business, that's not the way it is, because the employment component is so large. Why not change the timing of that so that you can look at both pieces at the same time? And if you need to go to arbitration, are you open to that?
Well, here's what I would say. I'm going to say things that are both in support of what you suggested as well as things that may be a different perspective. Is I get the point that 85% of what we do is in people. In fact, my view is our technology is not computers, it's people. Everything good and just that happens for a child, on your point on relationship, happens with an adult. And so, you know, I am willing, because we're going to have to be in those conversations, to look at all of that. But I also need the patience of time, and I think sometimes what people fail to understand is that some of these things are mandatory subjects of bargaining, that, in other words, we don't get to unilaterally change. You have to be at a table to do that, and oftentimes to get something, you have to be, you know, it's all exchange theory. So I'm willing to look at all of that. But I also want to say something that may resonate well and may not resonate well, but I'm going to say it, and that is that I believe that teaching needs to be a profession of first choice. And what I worry about is the 19-year-olds in this country, in this community, in this state, I don't care where you place them, that are saying, what do I want to be? And they go through the discussion and the numbers that choose not to go into teaching, especially, and I'm not trying to be, especially young males. Because if you look at the proportion of people going into teaching, it's just to make the point, very, very high percent female. Great female teachers, but especially at elementary, we need a balance. But what I worry about is teaching is not a profession of first choice in this culture. And I also think part of that is around what should a teacher make. And I think long term, and I know that there are different views on this, but you just need to know where I'm at. And that is that if we're going to do good work with teachers, we need to have the best minds going into teaching, the best teachers going into teaching. And, you know, if you look at the comparative data in terms of teaching salary, I mean, there are some issues there. And so I think we also have to be just with people, too. And where that is, I mean, I don't think, in many ways, in negotiations, you don't even get to that conversation because there's a limited amount of money in the revenue cap. I mean, and so if you look even at the settlements here, they've been fairly constant throughout. in terms of, you know, what they've been. And I think what they've been around 4%. And here's what's interesting about that. The QEO is at 3.8%. And people think that that's the ceiling in bargaining. It's not. It's the floor. Because the way the law has been created is if a district, which all districts will do, will put a qualified economic offer on the table, you foreclose going to arbitration on economic issues. But if you want a voluntary settlement, which is good for community, you're somewhere off of that 3.8. And Eric and I looked at that. Is the difference between the floor and the settlement is about 0.2% historically here. So part of it is also getting the accurate information out in terms of you know, what actually has occurred, and it's been awfully close to that, that qualified economic offer amount. So I understand.
Would you like to make any closing comment?
Yes, I would, and very briefly, just to reinforce that I understand that these are the public schools. And one of the things I've come to learn is that this is a, and I knew this coming here, this is a very dynamic community. And there are all kinds of different views, as there should be, about education. Is that, how did I put that? Did I put that all right? And I said to people kind of kiddingly, I've met with 18% of the different advocacy groups now. that's a made up number just to make the point. But there are very well organized groups of all types here. And, you know, the good news is that people want to talk about kids. And I want to have that conversation. And I, what I assure you is I will engage with you. Let's keep the, you know, the conversation respectful, and it's been great. I mean, I've not had any concern about that whatsoever. At the end of the day, there will be decisions that you agree with what I've made and some things that you won't. But what I assure you is I will be present with you, and if you want to know what happened or what went into that, I'm more than willing to have that dialogue, and I'm more than willing to be informed about where I go going forward by your ideas. So we'll do it here. You can meet with me individually. You know, I'll do whatever you would want to do. So both Eric and I thank you for this opportunity, and we hope it's just the beginning.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.